Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. We'll hear a presentation entitled Jazz for Curious Listeners with Lauren Schoenberg, Executive Director of the Jazz Museum in Harlem. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 25th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Mr. Schoenberg will be joined by several local jazz musicians who will be introduced from the stage. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mick Hale. I'm Director of Education here at the Durham Museum. And on behalf of our Board of Directors, our Executive Director, Leo Smith, and his staff, it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the Stanley and Dorothy Trulson Lecture Hall. Tonight, along with another Smithsonian affiliate, the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, we bring to you Jazz for Curious Listeners in celebration of Jazz Appreciation Month. Tonight's program will also feature four local musicians who are highly acclaimed throughout the region. On bass, Andy Hall. Drums, Steve Casella. Let me go back on that. Drums, Dave Nabity. Dave Nabity, my apologies. How about keyboard, Steve Casella? That's what I meant to say. And on guitar, George Walker. George wanted an entrance. Our featured guest this evening is Lauren Schoenberg, Executive Director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. Lauren is a leading jazz historian and performer who has won two Grammys, performed in the Clinton and Bush White Houses, authored the book The NPR Curious Listener's Guide to Jazz, and has led both the Lincoln Jazz Orchestra and the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra. Ladies and gentlemen, Lauren Schoenberg. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Lauren Schoenberg. I'd like to say how happy I am to be here this evening. And I want to tell you what you just experienced. Many times people might tell you what I'm about to say is probably not true necessarily. I never met these guys before. I met them within the last hour. These three guys, as I understand it, these three wonderful musicians, never played together as a unit. He knows him, and he knows him, and he knows him, and they know George. But as a group together, no. And when I came in, the first thing that they were asking me was, like, what are we going to do? What are we going to play? Because they're professionals. And professionals, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want my surgeon to walk into the operating room and say, so, what's up today? Scrambled eggs, you know, or something, you know. So in the same way, but I didn't want to tell them. Because, I knew how good they were, so I knew that I didn't have to worry about that. What you just heard was actual spontaneity. I walked out on the stage, and I said B-flat, and then I went into a blues. I didn't tell them I was going to play the blues, and you saw what happened, right? We went right into it. Now, well, isn't that wonderful? And I think the older I get, and the more I try to understand what jazz music is hopefully really about, the more I begin to think that what it really is, it's people getting along together. And people deciding to do something together at the same time for the greater good, and maybe even, you know, putting their egos aside as much as it's possible to, for any of us to do, and to create something in kind of a totality. And there are many, many, many links to be made between that and, of course, the country that we live in and the history and we're going to talk about some of that and the relationship of jazz music to America, because jazz is American music. It didn't happen in Africa. It didn't happen in Europe. It happened here. And it happened here because of a very specific set of events, which we'll talk about as we trace the history of it. Now, having said that, I could walk into a jazz club anywhere in the world, on any continent, and I've been in most of them, on any continent, if there's a jazz club or even just a bunch of good musicians, walking with my saxophone and just go, just start playing some tune like that, and they'll fall right in. So the first metaphor, and by the way, metaphor is a very dangerous word. That's the kind of word that induces what we call mass narcolepsy. Come on, man. Thank you very much. Did you run for governor or something? Okay. So that's the first thing is, okay, so you use the word metaphor and immediately people just start to go. Okay, so, but my bottom line is that jazz is a language. We talk to each other when we play. People will come up and say, it's so amazing what you do. There's no music up there. You're not reading music. They think that somehow jazz is just invented out of thin air. Jazz is not invented out of thin air. Jazz is a series of theme and variations. That's another term that's potentially dangerous. But it is a set of theme and variations, okay? In the same sense, all the people I was talking, if I have a conversation with any of you, right? We didn't rehearse the conversation. I don't think you worry about it. You know what I mean? Oh, I'm going to go talk to somebody, and I don't know what he's going to say. You just do it because you've had 1,000 conversations, hopefully, a million conversations, and hopefully some interesting ones. Consequently, the same thing happens here in music. We share a common base of experience in that sense. Now, there's another thing about jazz music. Actually, there's another thing about lecturing, which is when you talk too much. So when you think I'm going on talking too much, just raise your hand. No, I'm just kidding. Don't do that. Okay. No, but one of the basic things about jazz music is that when I talked about the theme and variation angle of it, and now, you all know this tune, or most of you do. I'll stop talking. What's the name of it? The Hatikva? No, I'm kidding. What's the name? I Got Rhythm. Okay. Now, I'm going to show you how jazz players play theme and variations, and how that if you understand what the theme is, then you have a real chance on really understanding. See, now I'm kind of contradicting myself. I said there's nothing to understand about music. There really is nothing to understand. But if you can get into it and follow the theme and the variations, that's what jazz players are doing all the time. Sometimes I hear music. Again, I'm a musician. Duh. But I'm a musician. I don't know what they're playing. You know what I mean? It's so far out and so abstract and so like this. I have trouble with it. And I've been studying music for 30-some-odd years. So I said, how do you expect people to even begin to know what the hell's... Excuse me. But, to know what the heck is going on, right? I can't follow it, right? You know what I mean? So I'm going to demonstrate to you the theme and variations very simply. So I got rhythm. One, two, one, two. Variation, same idea, backwards. New idea. Back to the melody for a moment. Funny quote. Another stupid quote. Okay, keep going. Same thing. follow it? Okay. Could you follow the ideas? One to one to one to one. Basically, that's what hopefully a good jazz musician does. And they do it either more simply or in a more difficult style. Now, in jazz, we have a saying, "Tain't what you do, it's the way that you do it." It's an old song from a long time ago. "Tain't what you do, it's the way that you do it." And what it means is that in jazz, you can take any tune. It's not the tune. It's what you do with it. In the same way, talk about improvisation. If I said here, everybody here improvises, and you say, "What are you talking about? I don't play the saxophone. I don't do this. I don't do that." You improvise every time you cook. Or at least I hope you do. I just saw a whole bunch of wives give a bunch of husbands a funny look. But anyway, the bottom line is you do improvise. Basically, as simple as an analogy as it is, a good jazz musician is like someone encountering on a Saturday morning, it's funny weather, you don't want to go out shopping, you open up the kitchen cabinet, you see what you got in there, and you say, "Okay, all right, so we'll have celery and potatoes." No, but seriously, you'll make something out of it. In a sense, that's what jazz musicians do with the theme. Now, I can take that theme of "I Got Rhythm" and play it as a waltz. It's still "I Got Rhythm." Give me a waltz. One, two, three, two, two. One, two, three, two, two. One, two, three, two, two. See, it's a waltz, right? Go up to D flat. Got it? Okay. You don't have to clap after each time. All right. Let's play a bossa nova in F. One, two, one, two. Half of you are saying, "Is he trying to be funny or is he serious?" Let me start with you. F. Okay, enough of that. Right. So we could do this in 15 different styles, right? I could say, "Give me a hip-hop beat." No, but seriously, okay, right. So we could, right, we say, "Lauren in the house." No, I'm just joking with you. But we could do it any number of ways, right? Okay, so you get the point. In the 19th century, I just read a wonderful book called Team of Rivals, and it was kind of a coincidence. A friend of mine read it. He recommended it to me, and I happen to have read it. It's a book about Lincoln's cabinet, in the bathroom. No, just kidding. No, but it's a book about his cabinet and about how when Lincoln was elected in 1860, took office in 1861, he put in his cabinet William Seward and Stanton and Edward Bates and all these people who thought he was a fool and who actually wanted to be president at the same time, and he put them in the cabinet. He made a wonderful thing happen. Now, why do I talk about that? Because I read about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, right? And Stephen Douglas and John Fremont and Breckinridge and all these people. It was kind of very interesting. I figured out that I'm coming out here. You know what I mean? Maybe I can take some spare time and go. I'm going to be in a museum, but you know what I mean? I can go and just, scout it out and kind of see what's happening. In the 19th century, American history, as you all know, we pretty much suffered for, we suffered from many things. Usually I teach kids, and so I'm here with an adult audience, so I don't mean to patronize, I don't mean to go over these basic things, but just to lay the groundwork for where I'm going to go with this. As you all know, this country of ours was built on a great lie and built on a great tragic misunderstanding. And the tragic misunderstanding was, of course, when it said that, everyone's created free, we weren't. So what did Abraham Lincoln do at the Gettysburg Address? What he basically did was redefine what the United States was about and said, "Well, actually, now we're actually going to take these words literally and actually say everybody is free in this country, or hopefully potentially free," and kind of redefine the Constitution. The great lie of the 19th century, one of the great lies of the 19th century, has its eventual effect, of course, in popular culture today. And we'll get there in just a moment. Now, what I'm talking about, of course, is the lie that was told and put into the center of our society had to do with slavery and had to do with, not even with miscegenation, but had to do with the fact of the most popular form of popular entertainment in the 19th century was what? Minstrelsy, right? We still see minstrelsy reflected in so much of popular culture today. There are many TV shows that are, in a sense, minstrel shows, okay? How odd that a society that had enslaved, right, this wonderful country that's advertising itself around the world as the first democracy and blowing its all horn, how wonderful that we have slaves in this country. How odd that the most popular form of entertainment was built on white folks putting on blackface to imitate the people who were enslaved. I mean, this is it's a sick thing, but it's something that's so important to understanding what our society is about. In New Orleans, there was a place called Congo Square. Raise your hand if you've heard of Congo Square. Good, then I'm happy to tell you about it, just a handful of people. Congo Square was a place where the slaves were allowed to dance around and deal with their memories of Africa and just enjoy, if you can even put in terms like that, enjoy a day off from slavery. There's no such thing. It's an insult to say that. But to kind of have a free day. And the white folks in New Orleans, and some of the free black folks too, would gather around Congo Square and watch these slaves dance around, and they thought that what they were doing was kind of comical. Because some of the dancing was kind of like what later became the cakewalk, and kind of with an attitude and kind of a face and strutting around. Isn't that, with a very condescending attitude, isn't that just wonderful? Isn't that just so wonderful? What they didn't realize was that even going back to those days, and if you've read Albert Murray or Ralph Ellison, these people are concerned with that in our society, it's like mirrors. And what we didn't realize is that what those slaves were doing at that time was mocking the pretensions of the masters. Who, when they went to church on Sunday, when they dressed up in their finest clothes, or when they walked around and acted with their, you know, like they were just better than everybody, right? So consequently, from the very beginning of this interchange of African idioms and African-American idioms, both things are facing each other like with mirrors, with a tremendous amount of misunderstanding. Now, what comes out of minstrelsy, and what in part fostered minstrelsy, and believe me, this has everything to do with your coming to a jazz lecture tonight, because, and I'm dead serious about that, because when we encounter jazz, what we're really talking about is what in the world is thought to be the most American art forms of all. And if we don't understand who the masters of the jazz idiom were and who created it and where it came from, then frankly, we're just dreaming in some dream world, not really understanding what this music is really all about and what you're all listening to when we play it, consequently. So the great lie of the 19th century was that you had to be scared of the black male slave, right? This was built into the popular mythology of the time because he's going to escape from the slave quarters and go out and ravage all the white women, right? Now, look at it analytically for a moment and say, now, if you're enslaved and they broke your family up, they took your daughter away, they took your grandmother away, they whipped somebody to... But how odd that these people would be so angry, right? And that they would want to do something revenge-like. Now, you take the amount, historically speaking, of when that thing happened, right? A slave escaping and wrecking horror. Right? Maybe it happened. It happened. Sure, it happened. Then you contrast that with the reality of the miscegenation and rape that happened from the white slave owners, right? Going back to, you know, and I'm not going to beat up on Thomas Jefferson because that's a very, very complicated story, right? If this thing I'm talking about happened this many times, how many times did the other thing happen? Exponentially, you can't even multiply it. But was that the great story of the 19th century? No. That was the shameful story that was kept covered up. Right? Right. Okay. So consequently, jazz music is a reflection of what happened in the 19th century. Slavery ended. This lid came off of all these racist conventions, which we're still dealing with today. I mean, I don't know about you, but I mean, how many of us, people younger than me, older than me, thought that we would live in a country where at least two presidential candidates would be a woman and an African-American, right? I mean, I know a lot of people said I would never live to see that day, right? So, you know, this is a country full of opportunity. But having said that, jazz music, in a nutshell, is when the lid came off slavery, 19th century, you had bottled up in this population of people, like in any population of people, incredible genius and incredible capability and incredible inspiration. So the top comes off. Is it any surprise that a Louis Armstrong comes out? Is it any surprise that a Thurgood Marshall comes out later? Or a James Weldon Johnson? Or a Du Bois? Or people like that? It's no surprise at all. Jazz music came from Louis Armstrong, who was born in New Orleans. Now, We're going to play a piece that began as a spiritual that you all know that became one of the most popular musics, one of the most popular songs, When the Saints Go Marching in F, okay? And then I'm going to ask you all to follow me at some point. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to ask you to do, but do what I tell you to do, okay? But then be surprised because you're not supposed to know. Okay, all right, okay. Da 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 I gotta stop there. I can't believe you fucked. Is this mine? Oh, it's mine now. See, you just surprised me because most times when I go to that last one, I just get like, you know what I mean? But you all actually did it. So, what's in the water here? I don't know what's going on. That was strange. Now, do you know where we just were?
Right, but also where were
we? We're in a church. Right. We were doing something that has been part of African-American churches, right, for hundreds of years, which is a call and response. And what it highlights is how absolutely intertwined into our culture, African-American culture, Caribbean culture, Scandinavian culture, Eastern European culture, all these things that comprise what we call American, correctly, are comprised of so many different things, but there is no element going across all of our popular culture that is as important or is as vital to it as the African-American contribution to it, right? Right. Now, going back to what I was talking before about with minstrelsy and about with Louis Armstrong and all this kind of stuff, it was thought that to show that jazz was as good as the music that we perceive to be the great music of all time, the music of Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, all that kind of stuff. Did you know that Bach and Beethoven, I'm talking about Herman Beethoven. Thank you, okay. No, but seriously, you know, Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Mozart, did you know that they were great improvisers? They were great improvisers. They did exactly what we do, probably only better, but they did exactly what we're doing for you today in the context of those times. And I mean, there are so many famous stories about, you know, King Shmuel or whatever his name was, you know, saying, Beethoven, play me the variations on so-and-so. And they would sit there and they would play for 30 minutes. And they were doing exactly what jazz musicians do, making, you know, improvising, composing on the spot, rhythmically, with a nice feeling, hopefully with a sense of humor in it, quoting all kinds of things, quoting church tunes, quoting popular tunes, quoting opera, all these various things. That was, unfortunately, there were no recording devices back then. So we don't know what it sounded like when Mozart improvised. We don't know what it sounded like when Bach improvised. So that was gone with the wind. See, remember I told you Gone with the Wind? But that was gone with the wind, right? So we never heard it. So we think that the essence of that music and the essence of those musicians is some cold, dry thing written down on some piece of music paper. It's not. If you were around Brahms, and you were a friend of his, you would have heard him at this famous beer hall called the Hedgehoggen, actually was the name of it, in Vienna, with a beer there, you know, at the, you know, playing this piano for 30, 45 minutes at a time, playing theme and variations. And that inspired his composition. So in other words, improvisation and composition of music are not really separate. I've gone on many different tangents tonight. I want to tie one up. This woman named Jeanette Thurber, 1892, to get over the perception that American composers need to study European models to get very serious. She wants to bring over someone like Brahms. Brahms can't come. They send his disciple. His disciple was Dvorak, Antonín Dvorak, the great Czech composer. He comes over in 1892, and they put together a group of students, a very liberal, diverse group of people for 1892, because it's not just white males, which is all it would have been. There were African Americans in there, and there were also women. And I'm not sure which of those two, frankly, is the more amazing for that time, because women were just out of everything. I mean, they were just out of serious running in the arts in those days. So they put together a very diverse group of people. Dvorak comes over to teach them how to write serious music, okay? And the newspapers come up to Dvorak. They want a quote. He says, I'm paraphrasing, of course. He says, just give me a few weeks to check out the music over here. I mean, I can't make any grand statement until I know what I'm talking about. So he went around. He listened to all different kinds of music. He asked his students, the black ones, the white ones, the women, and all different kinds of students, some Native American, actually, and said, you know, tell me about the different kinds of music in America. 2 weeks later, the reporter comes back and says, okay, Mr. Dvorak, tell us what you found. And he said, well, and again, I'm paraphrasing. He said, you know, I can teach them to write European music. He said, but the music that we write and play in Europe comes out of our society, our social conditions, our aristocracy, our the way that people can move vertically or they can move horizontally, but or the way that they can or the way that they can't. The sonata form, which is at the basis of classical music up until that point for the most part, is actually has many social analogies to be drawn from it. In America, you have your own music. So why don't you write your own music and leave this other stuff alone? And he said, they said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, Negro spirituals. He said, that's the root. That's the greatest music and the root of what I hear over here that's the most beautiful and the most original. Now, the Negro spirituals, as they were sung by the Fisk Jubilee Singers and other groups of the late 19th century, were also another merger of European classical tradition, African things, work, songs, all this kind of stuff, and it came into this form that eventually you might know as gospel and all this kind of stuff. But the early Fisk Jubilee Singers wasn't gospel at all. I mean, it was they were singing hymns. So consequently, what happens? Dvorak goes back and writes this famous symphony of his, which is called From the New World, and he writes in there. Right, he writes that beautiful theme played by the oboe or the English horn called, you know, what's it called again? Going Home. Right, okay, right, right, okay, right. He writes this beautiful thing, but what does Dvorak do? He takes his own advice. Remember that old saying, doctor, you know, heal yourself or whatever it is? He does what he said the American composer should do. Did he try and write a Negro spiritual, as it was called back then, with a choir and ladies singing and some idiomatic stuff? No, he wrote a symphony. So in other words, Dvorak says, I'm Czechoslovakian, or I'm from Bohemia, or whatever they called it in those days. He says, I'm going to look at America and write my version of it. So what he said to his American composers was, that's what you have to do. From your perspective over here, then you look at the other music. Now, one of the people who was a disciple, a student, for a short time, of Dvorak's, was a very important musician named Will Marion Cook. Will Marion Cook eventually became the mentor of Duke Ellington. And Duke Ellington is hands down, I mean, on the one hand, I'm against ever saying the greatest or the best because there's no such thing. But in my subjective opinion, there's never been an American composer. And I'm talking including Gershwin, Copland, Leonard Bernstein, John Carigliano, and all of them. There hasn't been one of them that can touch Ellington in terms of the capturing of something in his music that is so intensely American that it couldn't be anything else. Even with Gershwin, we hear the Rhapsody in Blue, and not to take anything away from Gershwin, not that he needs any help from me, but as wonderful as he is, and that's some of the most beautiful music ever written, idiomatically speaking, it still has Europe breathing down its shoulder. He's still writing half like Ravel and half like other people, and then putting in these bluesy melodies. That Ellington was light years beyond that. But however, to this day, in the New York Times, and I've had letters printed in the Times about it, where they talk about the serious composers, right? You still don't see Ellington's name in there. Very strange. I remember once there's a famous quote from Louis Armstrong, where they said to Louis Armstrong, Mr. Armstrong, almost like, you know, a parody of an intellectual, you know, Mr. Armstrong, would you consider your music art music or folk music? And of course, you know, you can't hand a line like that to Louis Armstrong, you know. So Louis Armstrong supposedly said, of course it's folk music. I never heard a horse sing a song. Okay, thank you. Okay. So anyway. So having said that, I'd like to play a couple of more songs for you to demonstrate what I don't know. But no, but seriously, I'd like to call up George Walker. Just me and him. You can sit down if you want for a minute. Yeah. We're going to play a duet. We've never played together before. We're going to play a beautiful tune. Well, actually, I'm not even going to tell you what the name is. It's so famous that it would be redundant of me to tell you that we're going to play Misty. So. Thank you. Thank you. The point being that from an intrapersonal standpoint, from a human standpoint, I mean, I never met him before. He never met me before, right? We talk backstage, you know, we know some of the same people, actually, and, you know, played in some of the same places at different times in our life. But, I mean, I never met this man before. I never met any of them. But through music and through art and through the fact that we're composing on the spot, we're depending on each other. See what I'm saying? It's different than if we were just reading the music. We're going to play, you know, I mean, we're going to play a piece of classical music or a piece of written music. Yes, you still have to depend on the other person. But it's like an actor with a script. They've got the script. There's no script here except that we said we're going to play Misty. But trust me, there's 1,000 different ways to play Misty, right? I didn't know how he played. He didn't know how I played. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? And it winds up being something kind of nice. Now, let me tell you something else before we get back to Dvorak and Ellington, just for one last minute. Jazz music is also unique because we play you. And again, that sounds not a cop-out or a glib statement. But we do play you in jazz because your vibration and your face and your attitude and your you in the audience, you do come back to us. And if we had, again, if we're playing the Brahms Sonata in E minor for cello and piano, your vibe would come back to us in terms of maybe how we played or the tempo that we played at, but that piece of music was going to be the same from the beginning to the end. And again, that's not taking anything away from it. You know what I'm saying? It's not better than. Too many times when we do comparative things in our society, of course, right? And this is what the Democrats are doing right now, well, all kidding aside, but seriously, you know what I mean? Why does it have to be like this, right? You know what I mean? You put up Ellington, then you're putting somebody else down. You put up Brahms, then, you know, it's not like that. But my point is, we do play you. And that's why every jazz performance, again, as glib as it sounds, every jazz performance is different. And every jazz performance cannot be the same as another one because of the musicians, but also because of you, the listener. And that's a very, very, very important thing that's hardly ever talked about. About Brahms and Ellington, I just want to have you walk out of here with two names, among others. And I want to get back to my other talk about slavery, etc., just to sum up in this way. In the 19th century, the word master had one connotation. And the connotation of a master was, of course, a slave owner. The North and the South, East to West, both shared, as we all know from studying history, great culpability and great responsibility for all kinds of things. I'm not one of these people who looks at any particular section of the country as really different in some ways than other sections. But having said that, master had a certain definition. By the time you get to the 1920s, the first band leader that I kind of made my name in New York with was Benny Goodman, who I was with for 5 years. And at this point, someone's going to come up to me afterwards and say, "You don't look old enough. When did he die?" And then I'm going to say, "Okay, honestly, I never played with him." No, but the truth is, I did spend 5 years with Benny Goodman. And Benny Goodman was one of the first generation of musicians for whom the black musicians were the masters. And that was a tremendous change in American psychology and American cultural history, where all of a sudden you have an Armstrong, you have a Coleman Hawkins, you have a Duke Ellington, you have an Art Tatum, you have a Thelonious Monk, you have a Billie Holiday, you have a Lester Young, and the list goes on and on and on. These are the people who created the music, and anybody who wanted to play it had to deal with these masters in the same way that the people in the other idioms dealt with Shakespeare and dealt with Ibsen and dealt with all these other people. And that was a huge, huge, huge change in a very, very short amount of time, right? Emancipation Proclamation is 1863, right? Louis Armstrong makes the West End Blues in 1928, and he changes the world musically. Bebop, what was called bebop music, is a music of genius played by people like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and Tad Dameron and people like that. Each one of those people's way of playing was different. Dizzy Gillespie is very different from Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker is very different from Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk is very different from Tad Dameron and Sarah Vaughan. But they got lumped under this name. And the way that the name came about was that Dizzy Gillespie and them were playing on 50 in New York, and they went, and somebody said, "Man, what's the name of that tune, Dizzy?" And he says, it doesn't have a name. Well, sing it to me. Boom. And believe it or not, that's how the name Bebop came up. Now, Dizzy Gillespie grew to rue that for the rest of his life, as did Max Roach and J.J. Johnson and these other people. They said, how can you expect people to take seriously a music called Bebop played by a guy named Dizzy? And that's kind of half funny and half not funny. You know what I mean? But it is kind of funny. On the other hand, you know, we didn't say, you know, tell me about that da-da-da-da music, Ludwig. You know what I mean, right? So in other words, even these little things are markers, are social markers and cultural markers, you know, for how we look at things. One of the things about jazz music is that it fosters a certain sense of informality that I think is very healthy. Once again, I want to thank these musicians. Let me just say one more time. They did something that exposed themselves musically, let's put it that way, in a way that many, many musicians would never let happen. I know many musicians who would say, I'm not walking on that stage with you tonight until you tell me what the heck we're going to do. You know what I mean? I'm a professional. And these guys had enough confidence just to let me come out and do this crazy thing, and I really do appreciate it. Let's hear for each one of them again. So we're going to go out with a tune by Thelonious Monk called Straight No Chaser. One, two, one, two, three. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series. We've heard a presentation entitled Jazz for Curious Listeners with Lauren Schoenberg, Executive Director of the Jazz Museum in Harlem. Besides Mr. Schoenberg performing on saxophone, we also heard Steve Cazella on keyboard, bassist Andy Hall, Dave Nabity on drums, and special guest guitarist George Walker. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, April 25th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next lecture in the series will be tomorrow evening, Tuesday, July 22nd at 6:30. At that time, geographer Andrew Johnston of the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., will present a program entitled Mapping the Source of the Amazon. More information on this and other lectures in the series can be found at durhammuseum.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.